Welcome back to our Total Sense Bite-Size episodes. I'm Tom Henske, and I'm here to help parents teach their kids about money.
Welcome back. Today, our guest is Vince Shorb. He's the CEO of the National Financial Educators Council. Wow, they are doing epic work. He's been doing this for 15 years. They work with 2,500 financial education programs. They have about 80 plus financial literacy assets. And he's focusing on guiding the industry of financial education, which, you know, we are all about, right? So he's aiming at a world where people are going to make informed decisions. And his big goal is to get a chapter for NFEC in all 50 states within the next 7 years. Wow, that's big time. Welcome, Vince. Tell us about this financial literacy journey that you've been on. It's been almost 15 or 20 years now, right?
It's adding up very quickly here, Tom. Thanks for having me. And yeah, it started really with my interest at a young age about money. That grew into having some successful investments at a young age. That grew into some dumb mistakes I made in my early 20s that cost me a lot of time, money, and problems. And then that led me into the financial service industry because I really wanted to make a difference. I spent about 15 years there, and I found a lot of people were making the same mistakes, and oftentimes a big part of their mistakes formed in childhood years and early teenage years and those first financial decisions. And so I want to start a company, the National Financial Educators Council, really to proactively address the challenges that people were facing. We've grown since then to serve all ages, but that was my main mission, is to help teenagers, young adults, and these kids avoid the problems I made growing up.
So what are some of those lessons that you've learned along the way that you're trying to pass to next gen?
I think there's the basic personal finance lessons, right? These aren't taught in schools, and really it's up to parents to teach their kids about money. And I was very fortunate. I had parents that were both sides of the financial spectrum. One side of my family was very frugal. I learned, you know, money management, paying attention to bills, expenses from that side. Another side that was very much entrepreneurial and investment oriented, and they would take those risks. So that type of balance was very beneficial to me. And I think if we can instill one strong work ethic in our kids at a young age, that was one thing both sides of the family had in common. That's a core component of success later in life. If we can help them understand to live below their means, it's tough today because we have a lot of external influencers, advertisers, social media stars, celebrities all saying, hey, you need to buy this to be cool and have self-worth. And we also have just basic the ability to save. And I think really what it comes down to, any type of personal finance, we can boil that down to somebody's ability to save regularly on a monthly basis while still planning for those things, those expenses that are coming up. And if we get our kids to start thinking about creating that habit of savings, working hard, minimizing their expenses, I think they'll live a much more secure life.
Isn't it crazy that you can literally boil it down to just putting money in an account once a month, every month from an early age, and then trying to increase that amount as you make more money? It's so amazing to me that, you know, people's financial decisions don't always align with their long-term goals. Why do you think that is?
And there's a lot of temptations out there, and, you know, there's a lot of ways that people can spend their money. A lot of finances is very behavioral. If we look at the studies, I know you're familiar with, Brown University study points to financial habits forming by age 9. Other people in other studies point to age younger, about 7 to 9 years old. And these habits, once they're ingrained, they're hard to break. So a lot of this is behavioral. It's not just very logical. And one of my challenges coming into, you know, the financial service industry and even into financial education, I'm very logical, analytical. Hey, the numbers make sense. Let's do it, right? I'll take this risk. I'll bring this on. And when you try to use logic on the majority of people that may not be making decisions on that level, simply because they might be making more emotional decisions or having this ultimate desire of wanting this satisfaction now, it can be challenging. So one of the big things I had to learn, and I think a lot of parents and other educators, it's a key thing when you're talking with your kids. If you're that analytical person, sometimes we need to adjust our language to fit the needs of our kids and our students. So that was a big challenge for me, but I think it's a lot of it is behavioral. Yeah, the price of things have gone up. Yeah, certain things. But if you're working hard, if you're able to control your expenses and you're gaining skills that are needed in modern day society, you're going to be able to save money, especially in America.
Okay. So when I'm on with the guru of financial literacy, everyone wants to know this question. If I only could teach three things to my kids, Vince, what would those three things be?
It would sound repetitive. Work hard, cut your expenses, and save money. And I always find it interesting that schools are so focused on subjects that are needed by such a few percent of people. If we look at high school, you know, we have advanced math filled with advanced math and science needed by less than 10% of people. We have foreign language needed by very few people. In fact, with the phones and so forth, that's taking over the foreign language industry. We're able to communicate with people in any language. Now, we have the first few years of English are good, then we have the last 2 years of literature. So if we need to make time, I have some suggestions for the schools on how they can do so.
Wow, you're going to be a fan favorite of all those Spanish and French teachers out there, that's for sure. But I get it. I get the point that you're making that we're probably not prioritizing the way that we should, right? That's what you're saying?
You know, priorities are key. So if we need to make time, there's ways to prioritize people's health. It impacts 100% of our youth. And it's important parents know that, hey, they're not teaching schools in any state at a level that will make any type of difference. Yes, they might have a 20-hour course or a one semester course, but try speaking Spanish, going back to your example, after a one semester course. You're not going to be able to do so. No hablo bien in that case. I took 2 years of Spanish, by the way.
Wow, that sounds like a native tongue with that accent, Vince. That was really good. Did you grow up in Mallorca or what was the deal there?
Yeah, Southern California, Texas now. So I try to speak Spanish when I can. I ordered 5 pounds of meat from the local meat market here in Spanish. It came out with 15 pounds. So I haven't done too good. But again, that points to the fact that if you're only teaching 20 to 40 hours of financial literacy in schools, your kids aren't going to benefit at all. It's critical parents take a long-term approach to this, starting at young age, using those fun activities and lessons, those conversational starters, those timely education topics, and preparing them for what's the real world is like. And so that's really critical. But yeah, I need to brush up a bit on my Spanish there.
So here's the thing I want to ask you about. What's going on with the states? You just talked about that. Are they making it mandatory? Is it an elective? And then I want to hear a little about what you're doing, because I think one of your goals might be in the next 7 years to get a chapter in every single state, right? Did I remember that correctly?
We're in 7 states currently. So we have the National Financial Educators Council. We're bringing out state chapters in the major states initially. And our focus there, at least in the first 7 states, is increasing access to quality financial education resources, not only for schools, nonprofits, but also for parents. I think it's critical that they know where to turn to get resources. It's another big important aspect of ours is to advocate for quality financial education programming. And that's a big problem. You know, there's about half states that require financial education. I said require differently because they're treating it not like a real class. They're not training teachers. They don't have funding for financial education. They're told to use free online resources. The curriculum isn't outcome-based or evidence-based. There's no clear measurements. So they're treating that like a joke. They're not treating it like a real class. Any other class in school is going to have paid curriculum, trained teachers, and so forth. But they're treating it like some random workshop that isn't so important. And really, when I think of all the subjects I spent time on in high school and my first 2 years of college, nothing would have been more important to me. It makes an impact on everybody's lives, from their emotional state to their overall health and security situation, to their willingness to be able to live those dreams and move forward and try those things that they want, maybe buy a home, start a family. It's delaying a lot of people. I just sold a rental property in California to a gentleman that was living with this 42-year-old. He bought it for him because he's tired of living with him, right? And he's nearing retirement. And you may think it was out of love, but his tone was like, I need to get rid of this kid, right? So it's really important that states are starting to take this seriously. It's really important that parents understand that it's not taught in schools at any level that's going to benefit them. So until they change, parents, please keep teaching your kids about money.
Well, I hear that poor guy who's got the 42-year-old living with him because, you know, the good news is my kids don't listen to me, so they'll never listen to this podcast. But I have a 21-year-old and a 17-year-old. And the whole idea of them still being in the house at 42, I'm giving them maybe 6 more months till I want to kick them out myself. So the idea of someone being 42 and still in my house, forget about that. That is never happening, not in the Henske's house. No way. So take me through one of your chapters that really is getting it right in the community. And can you paint the picture for our listeners as to what's going on and why it's working?
Yeah. So when we roll out a state, so like Massachusetts, for example, we rolled out and that wasn't our initial plan, but we met a really good guy there that was super, super passionate that said, hey, I want this in my state. I want to lead it. And really the first thing we do is we start to meet the people in the community and start to build a local advisory board. It's really important that it's geographic specific because they're going to know the nuances of those communities. Massachusetts, you know, you're in Boston and Westchester, which are higher end areas. You go a little bit out and it's a completely different area. So it's really important we're building relationships and board members that have a deep understanding of that state and have a passion for promoting this. From there, we start to roll out press and media announcements that are helping us find beneficiary groups. So those schools, nonprofits, and other organizations that say, we want to build and scale a financial wellness program. Our organization, we'll give any organization material, but we really want organization to invest into building and scaling a program so it can live on in perpetuity. And that's our big focus. We like to partner with them. When we do the launch, we're making announcements of all of our partners, board members, really to let the general community know, let them know, hey, there's resources, there's workshops, there's these organizations that are actually hosting programs. And from there, it's an ongoing advocacy effort. We work through with legislative efforts. We work through just general public awareness. And in addition, we're working with key stakeholders, whether it be school districts or school boards, et cetera, to promote financial wellness. Now, our focus isn't just on the school aspect. We know that will be a long-term change. That's why I'm really excited with what you do here is really reaching the parents, because I think that's step one. You know, our strategies with advocating for this in schools, it's a multi-decade type strategy. And I think really where the key need is with parents. So I appreciate what you guys are doing here. It's a huge need and a key aspect of our vision in these states. And then from there, we conduct a variety of interactive campaigns and promotions really to raise awareness. So, for instance, we have our Back to School Month campaign coming up. Ellis is leading that up in Massachusetts. And basically, it's a budget guide and worksheet and talking points that parents can use to have conversations with their kids when they're going back to school shopping. We all need to go back to school shopping, whether your kid grew 5 inches over the summer or needs pencils or pens or whatever the case may be. It's a great time. It's a teachable moment where we can have those conversations about, hey, what do we need? What's the estimated cost? What's the estimated budget? How can we reduce those costs? You know, when we're shopping, how can we do some comparison shopping? So we're able to cover a lot of things on the expense side with this fun activity. And we run those types of activities and workshops through the year. But our big goal is we want organizations to be able to scale, sustain, and make an ongoing impact in these local communities.
So many things packed in there. I don't even know where to go next. But the one thing that did come to mind is, how are these organizations paying for your resources?
So we get sponsors to pay for that, whether it be banking institutions, individual financial advisors, individual realtors, mortgage brokers. So typically our sponsors come from the financial service side because they have a vested interest in that. They're already in the business of financial wellness. It aligns with their brand. So whenever we do these types of opportunities, we always look for win-win-wins. How does it support the community? How does it support the organizations? And how can it support the sponsors? And that type of strategy works out well. It keeps us 100% independent on the national level. It keeps us the resources independent when they go to school. So there's no marketing or promotions to kids, which is great. And it just helps the community, you know, again, helps us fund all the media promotions and the, you know, the overhead to sustain those campaigns. So we're very grateful to our sponsors. Ellis Cooper of New York Life is our sponsor up in Massachusetts. Great guy again. And the key thing we look for sponsors isn't just money. They have to have passion plus money, right? So if they, hey, here's money, go do it. We're like, why do you want to be involved? Why is this important to you? What change do you want to see? What benefits do you want to see in the community? How do you want this to impact the outcomes? And if they don't have the right answers there, that we don't need their money, right? We want to surround ourselves with people passionate and committed to this cause. I personally think it's a social cause of our time. When we look at the number of people struggling financially right now, we have about 2/3 of the country that are in not a good position, about half the country that's in a very challenging position. And I think with money, it's not the key to happiness, but it is a major factor to a lot of people's overall well-being, self-worth, relationship. So it impacts so many areas. If we can help them with their money so they can sleep soundly at night, so they don't have the worries that I went through and maybe you went through and many people went through when they were growing up and coming out on their own, I would rest sleepful knowing that they're feeling better about themselves.
So let's talk about those people for a second. Where can people turn to for financial guidance if they don't have a lot of money or hardly any money to invest?
Yeah, great question. I think today there's the beauty of the information age. There's also risk. You know, back when I don't want to age myself, but when I was growing up, you had to go to the library. You're reading, you know, 30-year-old investment books, you know, in the Dewey Decimal System, right? Nowadays, you go to, you know, online and find a lot of information. The challenge is you need to qualify that information. Who's that coming from? What's their purpose? What are they trying to get me to do? Is there any ulterior motives, right? So I think we have a lot of sources of information out there. I always tell people, hey, you can find somebody on a podcast. You can find somebody that writes book. You can find somebody that's doing local workshops. That may be your immediate connection, right? Especially if you don't have that, you know, say 50 grand plus to invest or buy a home or do those types of things. You can find those mentors and relationships. Financial coaches are also a great source. They work with people of all levels, and they're providing that personalized guidance and education to you based on your specific situation. So I think coaches are a very great source and very untapped. A lot of people think, who am I going to go to? You know, let's say somebody's in debt. They're 30 grand in debt. They look up online and they see information from a debt negotiator, right? Well, they're going to be saying, probably go the debt negotiation route. If they continue their search, they might find somebody from a bankruptcy lawyer. They might be, you know, skewing the article, talk to a bankruptcy lawyer, right? A financial coach has a fiduciary responsibility to act in the best interest, just like financial advisors, to act in the best interest of their client. So they're not pushing products or services or actions to take. It's more, hey, what's your situation? Here are the options. Well, let's investigate that together. Now, once you get, you know, some money in the bank, again, you're going to have more access to qualified tax advisors, financial advisors, wealth management, realtors, etc. But that initial come up years, you know, when it's really a mistake can cost you a lot. There's some limited choices. But again, today with the information age, we have a lot of options.
Well, it's so interesting hearing you talk about libraries. I was so proud of the Westport Library when I saw that they actually have a program where they give access to anyone in the public to resources that would be paid resources like Wall Street Journal Online, Morningstar.com. And I thought that is such a cool thing, because when libraries start getting involved and making it accessible, meaning financial literacy, I just thought that that's awesome. So yeah, you're right on a lot of that stuff, that it's like we need to make it more accessible, and it's the staging of what stage you in until you can graduate to getting that professional financial advice.
Yeah, and I agree. Libraries of today are completely different than when I grew up. There's computers. They provide so much access and information. I wholeheartedly agree. I love libraries today. They do a lot of workshops for free and so forth. So yeah, I concur there. I was referring back to my days 40 years ago, where's a smaller library and the information a bit outdated, right? But I think libraries have caught up with the times, at least many of them.
Lastly, let me ask you this question. To a parent, when they think of the phrase financial literacy, what does that mean, or what should it mean?
It's an excellent question. I think a lot of people think financial literacy, and if you look at the technical definition, it just means knowledge of personal finance. Knowledge means very little in the space. You have a lot of knowledgeable people that know how to have a good credit score, how to have a balanced budget, how to save, that aren't doing it, right? So when we look at financial literacy, we in the industry look at it broader. So I'm looking at somebody's behaviors. I'm looking at somebody's confidence in making decisions and about the ability to act on their knowledge of the topic. I'm looking at what systems they have in place, the team members they have, the progress they're making, what happens when things go off course, are they resilient, right? So all these, we look at, even though financial literacy, that term is you know, just knowledge of money, without those other factors, without the behavior, sentiment, systems, teams, etc. And that knowledge goes very far. Now, like any other course, you know, knowledge is what they test on, right? So you, can you pass the test? Well, great. You have the knowledge. You can move on to the next level. With personal finance, we need to treat that differently. And asking our kids these questions, if they went to, let's say, a financial education workshop, we can ask a question. Hey, did you know, since you did that workshop, has any of your, you know, behaviors changed since you did that? Or how are you feeling about money? Do you think you, you know, thinking 5 years in the future, what do you think that would mean to you? Now, younger kids, we not may not be able to ask those questions, but as they progress and we can be more conversational with our kids, those are all good things. Or if, let's say you do an activity at home, like a challenge where you're trying to reduce the electric bill from last year. So you sit down, cover the electric bill with a kid from the prior year, and you're talking about if we can reduce that by 10%, you know, you're explaining what that is and setting a goal together and doing that, then you can have some discussion time, some reflective time after. Hey, what does that make you think about, you know, the cost of electricity? Do you think you're going to try to keep those lights off, you know, moving ahead? So we can even bring that to a parental level. I think the time for reflection and conversation is a key way we can instill knowledge in our kids. It doesn't have to be always formal. It can be game-based. It can be conversational. But again, getting them to getting an understanding of what difference it actually made is critical.
Well, Vince, this was awesome. The work you're doing with the National Financial Educators Council is awesome. And we so appreciate you coming to visit us today and spending the time. So thanks for being with us.
It's my pleasure. Again, I'm very appreciative of your efforts, what you're doing, and I look forward to seeing continued great things from you.
I hope you enjoyed our episode of Total Sense. A special thank you goes out to Verso Studios at the Westport Library. Tune in for our next Money Chat.